Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's the only place outside of a Guns N' Roses tour bus to get the world-renowned, much-anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho. Duff McKagan calling you from Milano, Italy. Susan's here.
Ciao.
Ciao, Chris Jericho. Listen, you know why you shouldn't brush your teeth with your left hand? Yeah, because a toothbrush works better. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right, Duff and his wife Susan bring the laughs from Milan, Italy, as Duff does every single week for the last 5 years. Duff and his wife are touring with Guns N' Roses in Europe right now after they missed one show in Glasgow due to illness. I was there the same night as Duff was in Glasgow. And they're back and rocking. They actually added more dates to their upcoming tour of Japan. GunsNRoses.com has all the information and all the ticket info, all the dates, everything else you need to know, as does FozzyRock.com have all the information about our next tour, the Save the World Tour, firing up again September 8th in Columbus, Ohio. We're even headed to Canada for a few shows. FozzyRock.com has all the dates and ticket information, along with details on our legendary VIP meet and greets. We're also headed back to Europe in November. We start in Manchester on November 4th, and we hit Birmingham, Nottingham, Dublin, Belfast, Swansea, Bournemouth, Bristol, Glasgow, London, before we take the show down under to New Zealand and Australia, kicking things off in Auckland, November 28th, and hitting Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide. Come rock with us this fall. FozzyRock.com for all information on ticket and VIP meet and greets. You don't want to miss it. And you don't want to miss today's show. Legendary producer, engineer Alan Parsons, who got his start at Abbey Road Studios working for the Beatles. He's the guy in the orange shirt, black tie, and striped jacket in the rooftop footage from Get Back. He was there. He tells us all about it, what he did, what it was like to see that famous, monumental, legendary performance live, and what he thinks about Peter Jackson's 8-hour documentary, Get Back. Alan also talks about meeting the Beatles for the first time, what it was like to be in the studio with them, Sir Paul, what it was like to work with McCartney, and of course, being with George Martin, and longtime Beatles engineer Jeff Emerick. He also shares some great stories about working on Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd's classic album, seminal record. He's the guy who came up with the clock sounds on Time, all the cool change effects on Money, and wait till you hear what they had to do back then to get those sounds. Alan also talks about his own band, the Alan Parsons Project, as made famous by Dr. Evil, which we'll also talk about as well from Austin Powers, and what it was like to be called out in the franchise. We'll also hear about Alan's brand new solo record, From the New World, which features guest appearances from Tommy Shaw of Styx, guitar player Joe Bonamassa, and David Pack from Ambrosia. Album actually came out today. Get it wherever you buy or stream music, and order one of the limited edition colored vinyl copies at alanparsons.com. Here we go. Alan Parsons of the Alan Parsons Project, right here, right now, on Talk is Jericho. Here with Alan Parsons, legendary Alan Parsons. So much history, so much to talk about. But you mentioned earlier that you just had some surgery. I was reading about it. Is that from years of touring and holding guitars?
No, I think it's the culmination of not looking after myself for a number of years. No, it's a spinal problem. I've had back trouble for many years, and the doctor I went to see said it's time we fix this. So he
gotcha.
Put me under the knife for 4 hours.
So. And here we are. But that is something that people don't realize too. Like when you're on the road and touring, a touring musician and touring, the travel and the wear and tear, it does get to you after a while. Most people don't realize just how much of a stress it is on your body and your mind to be touring, like you mentioned, for so many years.
It does take its toll. From being said by several musicians, I think that playing the gig is free. It's the travel that the promoter pays.
Yeah. The 22 hours on the road is what you get paid for. The 2 hours is the good part, right?
Right.
Because the interesting thing for me is that you didn't tour ever with the Alan Parsons Project when you guys were in your heyday. You just started touring after. Why didn't you ever do some touring? You know, I remember Eye in the Sky when it was really popular, and those records, you never went on the road.
No, we made the decision. I mean, you know, the Alan Parsons Project was essentially two people. It was Eric Wolfson and myself. Mm-hmm. Just for the record, Eric died sadly in 2009. But we made the decision, no, we're just going to be a recording outfit. I mean, I had no particular aspirations towards being a rock star, you know, a stage rock star.
Right.
We just decided we will promote the albums by going to the radio stations and, promoting, doing interviews and doing playbacks for the media and the press and stuff of new albums as they appeared. And it seemed to work well. I mean, we managed to, get into the upper reaches of the charts and
sure,
it worked fine. It was only much later in the mid-90s that I felt the need, because I'd made an album under my own name, not as Alan Parsons Project. We dropped the word project, it just became Alan Parsons. Mm. It seemed like a good idea at the time to give the album that I'd just made every possible chance of success. And that's what we did. We formed a band and we toured Europe. In the early years, I was very much a backseat passenger guy.
Right.
Just strumming my guitar. And, so over the years, I just became more confident. And believe it or not, there I am on stage right now doing lead vocals and singing Eye in the Sky of all songs.
it's interesting because, like you mentioned, Alan, it was almost like you were a late bloomer as a recording artist because, like you mentioned, for being behind the scenes and the engineering and the producing that you did, was it overall goal always to do your own stuff, or did you just one day go, I want to do something else that rather than working on other people's music?
I think I always wanted to keep my production chops in check, as it were. But I had no particular aspirations towards being a concert or arena act. It was all just about recording. And I've always had a studio. I've always wherever I've lived, I've always had a studio to work in.
Sure.
But it just seemed to make sense. That was an album called Try Anything Once in the mid-90s. And then I carried on with those guys, the same guys, many of whom had appeared on the project albums, but Eric was ensconced in a legal battle with this producer of a musical show that we worked on together.
Gotcha.
I just needed to earn money because my assets were frozen as a result of that.
The lovely music business, right?
Oh, God.
Was it a surprise when Austin Powers came out and they made the Alan Parsons Project joke in the movie? Was that a surprise to you? Did you know it was coming?
I had no idea at all. No, but arguably, I've got more exposure through the giant laser than I have through anything else.
It's one of those things that introduced you to a whole new generation of fans, right?
Yes. I mean, it's slightly upsetting that Mike Myers or the music editor or somebody didn't contact me, because I would have gladly made a musical contribution to the soundtrack album. Or mm-hmm. In fact, we'd actually borrowed some lines from Dr. Evil to do a sort of dance mix of one of the album tracks on a later album called The Time Machine. So we heard this sort of tuneful, melodic, trancey kind of rhythm, and then over the top you would hear Dr. Evil saying, "It was invented by the Cambridge physicist Dr. Parsons. Therefore, we shall call it the Alan Parsons Project." Did I get the right? The public can't see me. Maybe I've got the wrong little finger.
You've got the finger up to your mouth, the very Dr. Evil-esque, yes. Well, let's talk about I want to talk, obviously, about some of your most famous engineering and producing that you've done, but let's talk about your new record, From the New World. Was this something that you had recorded during lockdown?
Yes, we did. It was very challenging to actually get the band together. I didn't want to do it piecemeal. I didn't want to do the drum track and then add the bass and, you know, and then add this. And add
right.
I'm totally used to working with a complete band in studio. I heard Nancy Wilson doing it on your show.
Yeah.
Telling you that she did it. That's exactly that. She'd do her guitar part and then send it away and to the bass player and to the drummer and then send it back.
So yeah.
I'm really not into that. I much prefer the live collaboration between musicians. Having said that, we did do some vocals and guitar solos at a distance, but we did it live. You know, I didn't have them send files back the next day. So we use an internet program called Source Connect, which allows you to essentially be there. I mean, they get the track and they play the track at their end and they do their bits, and then I say, well, that was great, except why don't you come in 2 bars earlier or whatever. So it's exactly like being there, except that they don't wander into the control room after they've done their thing and listen back. it works really well.
That's cool, because there's something that I noticed, especially if you're doing Zoom or StreamYard, there's always such a delay. So we can have a conversation, but if we tried to sing Happy Birthday right now, there'd be a delay in the syncing. So what you're saying with this, what did you say it was called? Source?
Source Connect, it's called.
Source Connect. So you didn't have that delay? You didn't have that problem?
Well, it really doesn't matter, because everything that they do at their end gets delayed by the same amount before I hear it.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I gotcha.
So there's no sync problem at all. There's a bit of a problem on the communication, you know, when you're talking. It's going up to the right. Satellite and down again. So there's like a 2 second gap between me saying something and them hearing it. It's like a news report on CNN. You know, you have to wait,
sure,
wait for the person to hear what's been said and then contribute what he or she is.
When you put together the record, you have a lot of kind of guests on the album, guest musicians. Are these guys that you've worked with in the past, or just guys that you went, hey, I'd like to do something with Tommy Shaw or whatever it may be?
I hadn't worked with Tommy Shaw, but I had heard through the grapevine that he was a big fan. So it wasn't a problem to get him to do a song. He did a song called Ouroboros, which is already out as a single.
Mm-hmm.
The album itself comes out July 15th. But Tommy Shaw's, and the other single that's been released is with David Pack on the lead vocal. David Pack is the ex-lead singer of Ambrosia.
Ambrosia.
That I did the first, I worked on their first two albums. I mixed their first and produced their second album. Then they started having number one hits and I wasn't around.
Yeah, the biggest part of me, that was their big hit, right?
Yes.
One of them at least, yeah.
They failed to have any success in the UK because Ambrosia is a brand of canned rice pudding.
So, really?
Yeah. the name just didn't gel in the UK for some reason. Well, for that reason.
I think it's something here at American Thanksgiving has some kind of ambrosia, which is jello and whipped cream and that sort of thing. So it's a dessert in both continents.
Oh, it is. Oh, I didn't know that.
I believe so. Yeah, yeah. So when you do a record, and now, you know, in 2022, obviously as an artist, you always want to stay creative. Is it something that you want to go and play some of these songs at some point as well in the live setting?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the COVID has literally stopped so many bands from performing for a 2 year period.
Right.
And we did manage to pull off a brief tour in January. And the sad thing is I've just had spinal surgery, and I was all ready to do a European tour. But I was in agony. Oh. I could barely walk. So it was clear that I couldn't make that tour. So I'm hopeful that I'll be good, you know, in a couple of months, and I'll be able to get back to it. But for now, I'm fighting off some pain and taking painkillers, and, you know, but I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine.
Used to take painkillers in the 70s and 80s for fun. Now you have to take them for actual pain.
I'm pleased to say I'm actually off the painkillers now, except if I wake up at night, I might.
Right.
But I'm good during the day these days. it's a huge disappointment that I haven't been able to do this European tour. It had some really nice shows in Holland, some festivals in Spain and France, and the Montreux Jazz Festival, which I would have so loved to have done that.
Oh,
I hope they have me back on some other occasion next year, hopefully.
Is that kind of your biggest area is in Europe, where you have the most fan base?
Not so much Switzerland in particular, but Germany is a very big market.
Gotcha.
And Switzerland is on the border of Germany's Austria, and Italy, of course. So, yeah, we do well in all those places. Holland's a big place, very, very big place for us.
It's so amazing to me talking about your career and about your new record now and talking about the stuff that you've done in the past. And obviously, the thing that really blew my mind was the Get Back movie, Peter Jackson's movie, and up on the rooftop, and there's a young Alan Parsons up there running cables and all that sort of thing. First and foremost, did you have any idea that footage existed? Because it blew my mind that we had to wait 50 years to find out that this actually was even a thing.
Well, it's true. I didn't know it existed because I basically assumed that the original Let It Be movie, you know, Michael Lindsay Hogg's movie, if there had been a little snippet of me, he might have included it. He might not have included it.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter Jackson was gracious enough to call me about 6 months before the film came out and met me at his Beverly Hills hotel room and played me some clips. And there I was, large as life. It was a great feeling. He not only put some clips in his movie, but he actually put me on the screen with a credit saying Alan Parsons tape operation. And that was a real feel good for me. It was great.
Before we talk about the rooftop and that, how did you end up starting to work with the Beatles in the first place?
I'd been working at Abbey Road Studios for the previous 3 months or so at the age of 19. And I turned 20 in December, which made me 20 years old when I was sent down by Abbey Road to assist at their studio at the Apple Building in Central London. I was still fairly green, just a newly trained tape operator.
Mm-hmm.
But there I was, all four Beatles, George Martin, all the wives and girlfriends. And it was an extraordinary experience. It really was. And I was there on the roof for the entire concert, not doing anything particularly useful. I was just there watching.
Well, let's talk quickly about Abbey Road, because what it was like back then when you worked for the studio, it was almost like you were a contracted employee of that studio and they would send you to do whatever needed to be done for the recording. Whoever was in there, whatever band was in there, you would just go in whatever assignment they gave you. Is that kind of how it worked?
Well, I was an employee. Abbey Road was an EMI entity. Beatles were on EMI. If the Beatles wanted some help from Abbey Road, they got it.
Right.
I was the one sent down to help.
Did you have like an impressive potential, or why did they send such a young guy down to work with the biggest band in the world potentially?
I can't answer that, but I'm just so glad they chose me because it was an incredible experience. It really was. There were a couple of other guys that filled in either side of me, but I was there for the few days leading up to the rooftop and the rooftop itself. So,
well, you also engineered Abbey Road, correct?
No, I was still the tape op.
Okay.
Abbey Road was the following summer of 69, and I was still very much very green, very, very new to the whole thing, but I was working with the best. I was working with George Martin, with Jeff Emerick, all the other great engineers working at the studio at the time. But it was probably another year and a half before I was let loose on the board actually engineering.
What was George Martin like as a producer? I mean, obviously as a genius, but from your experiences with him?
I was always incredibly comfortable with him. He was always respectful of Abbey Road staff. He was respectful of the artists he worked with. I think the artists were equally respectful of him because he spoke their language. If he had an idea for something on one of the songs on Abbey Road, they would listen and they would try it. And more often than not, his idea was a good one. So he really was, I believe, the fifth Beatle, as he's referred to as. I think he was the ultimate diplomat. In some ways, I like to consider that I model myself, my production values, the way I work on him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was the ideal producer.
Well, and that's a great point. As a producer, you have to be a diplomat, right? When you're dealing with artists and you want to make sure that you guide them in the right direction, but you also can't be too stiff because then you might insult them. So there very, very much is a lot of diplomacy there.
Absolutely. There's the famous line of George Harrison saying, "I don't like your tie." let it go over his head.
Did you have a lot of personal experiences with the Beatles, with the guys?
Really, that came later. I mean, on the Abbey Road sessions, I was in a connected room with a glass partition. There wasn't much actual verbal contact with the band, more with Jeff, the engineer. But later on, I got to, as I progressed and got more established as an engineer as opposed to a tape op, I started to work with Paul. I did the Red Rose Speedway album, a couple of singles.
Mm.
It started with me engineering a couple of mixes on Wings Wildlife, which he liked, and he took me on. He took the risk, and hopefully I delivered.
Well, how do you work with Paul McCartney at that point? I mean, are you suggesting to him? Is he putting a lot of trust in your thoughts?
As an engineer, you're meant to just keep your mouth shut. You're meant to do what you're told, get a great sound.
Oh, gotcha.
And, use the best mics, get the best possible balance and so on. But Paul was pretty demanding. He would not be very good at describing what he's looking for. He would just say, make it sound better. Let's get a better guitar sound. Let's get a better drum sound. Let's get a better vocal sound. And that was the means towards experimenting, which often produced great results. You know, if you tried something you never tried before in order to make that sound better, then I would try it.
How was that back in the late 60s, early 70s, as far as the equipment, the recording equipment, setting up the mics, even, how many tracks were you able to record at once?
I'm pretty sure we had got to 16 track by the time I was working with Paul.
Okay.
But Abbey Road was 8-track, Let It Be was 8-track. Incredible, really.
How could they do all that on 8 tracks? Just keep doubling it and splitting it?
Well, you had to make more choices. You'd have to put all the drums on a track, or maybe bass and drums on a track, and then a guitar on a track, and then the other guitar on a track, vocal on a track. So yeah, you just had to be much more committal than you did later on. You could, by the time 16-track came along, you could easily record drums on 4 tracks, get drums separate, the snare drum separate, everything else as a stereo left and right pair. But then we got to 48-track, and now it's completely unlimited, which is in some cases a nightmare because people will not commit to making the choices that they need to make. And mixing takes forever. Because it becomes a process of choosing different performances, different vocal takes, different drum takes, different bass takes. It's a nightmare. But I like to think that I'm reasonably decisive and I can always just come straight to a song that we've been working on and know that it's going to be the definitive version that people will eventually hear.
Well, I would assume that you're fairly adept at with all the new technology and the fact you were making records for 50 years, just how much things have advanced. But like you said, the more technology there is, sometimes that makes things even not as good. I mean, there's less humanity in music now because of technology that you can use to sweeten things and tighten things, et cetera, et cetera.
It can be a plus. It can be a minus. Everybody's very in tune with timing, tuning.
Mm-hmm.
There are things in the past that today just sound horrific. You go, oh my God, how could they ever have let that go on that record?
Yeah.
You can make it perfect, perhaps at the expense of the feel being diminished in some way. But I love it. I love the cut and paste aspect of modern recording.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing backing vocals, for example, oohs and ahs, or harmonies on a chorus, you only have to do it once, then you can paste it into the next chorus.
Yeah, right.
You spend a lot of time, believe it or not, we did spend a lot of time in analog days winding the tape to a certain point, just winding it from the winding it from the end to the beginning was, a good sort of 25-30 second operation.
Yeah.
Whereas in the modern world on the digital audio workstations, as we call them. You can go to any place immediately just by touching a button.
Right, right, right.
Not only that, but then if you wanted to go to another song in the old days, you'd have to wind the tape off, take it off the machine, put it in the box, put it on the shelf, take the next tape out, put it back on. It was all very, very time consuming.
And if you had to make any edits, you'd have to do it with the razor blade and tape it and cut it as well, right?
Yep, yeah. All editing was real. I mean, you literally cut the tape. It's almost uncanny that we managed those days with the available technology.
Let's talk about the rooftop. What do you remember about that day? And obviously, probably didn't realize it would be one of the greatest, most talked about concerts of all time. And there was probably only 15 people on that rooftop, and you were one of them. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I've only got two still photographs to prove that I was there. Now I've got the Peter Jackson movie, of course, that shows one very brief moment where I'm adjusting something on the drums by Ringo's kit. It was an extraordinary day. It was very last minute. We ran cables up the stairwell from the basement studio up to the roof, took all the mic stands up. It was a cold, blustery morning. And Glenn Johns, who was the engineer, he sent me out to buy some ladies' pantyhose to put over the mics to stop the wind getting in there.
Oh, wow.
What a very strange reaction from the shopkeepers, you know, me buying ladies' leggings. And I think they thought I was a cross-dresser, or I was going to go put them over my head and rob a bank, you know.
Rob somebody, yeah. So that was what you had. And so you mentioned that you were just told about this earlier in the day. It was a last-minute thing. Hey, you got to go up on the roof.
It was the day before that it was decided to do it.
Oh, wow.
So I think that afternoon and evening, we ran up the cables. Miraculously, everything worked. Everything functioned. And up they came, and they started playing. And then the rest is history. But I think Peter Jackson's movie captures the essence of what the rooftop session was much better than the original Let It Be movie.
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing to me, too, that you couldn't see them, you know, from the street. You couldn't see anybody.
Right.
You just heard them.
It is extraordinary, that, isn't it? There were a few neighboring rooftops that were up there looking from across the street. But yes, it was. And I love the interviews from the street, you know.
Yeah.
Who is it? Is it the Beatles? Yeah.
It woke me up from my nap, and I'm not happy. That was my favorite. So what was your job during the gig?
Well, during the gig, I was just there to make sure nothing broke down, especially in the 60s. Equipment was much less reliable. Power supplies went down for microphones and things like that. So I was just there to make sure that everything remained working. I would have been summoned to change a mic or change a power supply if there need be, but there I was. I made the mistake of plonking myself behind one of the movie cameras. If you want to be in a film, you should not be behind the camera. You should be in front of it.
See, so, lessons that you learned as a show business veteran now.
Yeah, exactly. two little shots. I was on stage right, closest to Paul's side of the stage. In the original book, you can see a couple of shots of me wearing an orange shirt, a black tie, and a striped jacket. Not looking in the least important at all.
And how long was the set?
I don't know. It felt like about an hour, all told. They played some of the songs twice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that came through in the latest movie, that they played some of the songs twice. Probably not. They probably just chose the best performance of each one.
Well, yeah, because they actually used some of those on Let It Be itself, on the record itself, right?
Yes, indeed. I actually felt that there was a better Get Back than the one they actually used.
Oh, yeah?
Just for my own taste.
Were you a Beatles fan?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Biggest, huge, huge, huge fan of Beatles.
So that must have been, were you kind of a little bit nervous around them for being such a big fan?
The first day, I mean, I literally pushed the control room door open, and there they all were. Glenn Johns, George Martin, Linda Eastman, Yoko Ono. Hello, I'm Alan. I've come to help. So they said, well, there's the tape machine. We'll be right with you. So they were gracious enough.
Was it cool watching them that close? I mean, just the harmonies that they had and the chemistry that they had.
Yes, it was great. I was just in heaven, you know, there, you know, 3 months into my first job after leaving school, effectively, or soon after leaving school, I'm working with the greatest rock band of all time. How bad can that be?
Yeah, right. And like I said, being a part of one of the greatest gigs in rock and roll history. You're also part of one of the greatest albums, another one of the greatest albums in rock and roll history, talking, of course, about Dark Side of the Moon, working with Pink Floyd, which is another huge, ridiculous band that's very much into Sonics and the prog element, which I think you're very adept at as well. How did that all come about?
I'd been working with them a couple of times as a tape op on Amagama. Actually ended up mixing the previous album to Dark Side of the Moon, Atom Heart Mother, because Peter Bowen, who'd done the most of the engineering for that album, was not available. And rather than bring in somebody who didn't know the music, they gave me a chance.
Right.
You know the music, you know the console. And that was, you know, pretty much my first major gig as an engineer to mix. And presumably I did a good enough job for them to ask for me in the first Dark Side sessions.
So, I mean, obviously you got a different group of guys, but still complete geniuses with, you know, Roger Waters and David Gilmour. And you can never answer this properly, but when you're making Dark Side of the Moon, do you realize just how massive it's going to be? Are you thinking this is going to hit, or is it just another record? Was it special?
I think everybody in the band, everybody associated with the record felt it was without doubt their best work to date.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody expected to be talking about it 45 years later or whatever it is.
Yeah. Right, right. One of the biggest selling records of all time in the charts for 20 years and all that other stuff.
Actually, it's 50 years now, isn't it?
Is it 50? Probably, right?
72 to 22.
Hmm. What was it like working with David and Roger? I mean, but we don't really know a lot about them. Obviously, there's a million stories about John Lennon and Paul McCartney and the Beatles, but they're a little bit more mysterious, the guys in Pink Floyd, as far as what they were like as artists.
Yeah, I mean, it's of course lamentable that David and Roger don't see eye to eye.
Yeah.
But everything was fine back then. Everybody was, you know, relaxed, got on well, and actually enjoyed the process of recording. I was pleased to be a part of it. You know, I think we made a good team. It's actually a shame that I only did the one record with them, effectively, as the engineer from start to finish. Because I think we were a good team. I could have done some more work with them. And they actually offered me a job after Dark Side of the Moon. They said, come and work for us full time. And I politely declined because my production career had already started taking off. I was getting hits as a producer. Although it's a shame that we only did the one record. I made the right decision.
Dark Side 2 as well, we're talking about technology. There's a lot of sound effects on there, but I'm assuming you're not just pulling up samples like you would now. Like we're talking about, like, let's say the cash register on Money, for example. Is that something you guys had to actually do live?
Abbey Road had a steel cabinet full of tapes of sound effects. I'm pretty sure the cash register was on one of those sound effects tapes. The other sounds on that intro loop for Money were self-generated. We, you know, we threw money in the air and we dropped bags of money onto the wooden floor of the studio. They're all fairly distinctive sounds. The only slightly odd sound is actually a telephone exchange, which goes. It sounds right, but it doesn't really bear any relationship to money. The compilation of that loop was incredibly complex, getting it to work correctly.
Where did that idea come from? Because like you said, it is so unique of using this money as a melody almost.
Well, yeah, the loop was used as what today we would call a click track.
Right.
It actually played to the loop, that loop. So it had to be dead on right timing wise. I think if the album had been made today, that loop would have taken 5 minutes, literally.
Yeah.
But we had to literally take each sound, put it on a four-track tape. We chose four-track because we were doing quadraphonic sound at the time so that each sound would wander around the room. That was the idea. And we literally had to get a ruler out and measure the exact length of tape so that it remained in tempo or in time.
Oh, wow.
It took all day to get it right. And then We made a tape loop, hanging the tape around mic stands and anything available to hold a tape taut. transferred it to the 24-track master, and then they played to it. That's how it came together. I think you asked me about the original idea. Where did that come from? Roger had done a demo with a similar loop, but with completely different sounds and done very differently. Mm. We used that for the record. We used it when we played live. I didn't mention that I'd not only engineered the album, but went out and did gigs with them, playing the album for the first time to the American audience, which was good fun.
What were you doing when you said you did gigs with them? Doing the sound or engineering?
Yeah, doing the front of house, yeah. Mixing.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
And they had speakers behind us, at the side of us, as well as in front of us. So it was an interesting setup.
Well, they're always so much into the full-on experience, sound, vision, the whole show.
Oh, it was always visual as well. They were masters of getting the right lighting designer and special effects guys to make the show special.
So how do you do front of house for Pink Floyd? That's interesting to me.
It's the same as anybody, really, but
yeah.
They did have this unusual speaker configuration. We could make sound literally go around the building. It didn't work for anything rhythmic because the laws of physics don't allow anything rhythmic to be at the front of the house as well as in the back of the house. So just spacey sections, you know, the intro section, for example, took full advantage of the speakers being in the four corners.
Was it a similar idea when you had the clocks for time?
Similar thinking, yes. I mean, we knew that the clocks had to be recorded on four different tracks so that in quadraphonic they would appear from all directions. That was one of my main contributions to the record, actually. I had recorded those clocks for a sound effects record in a local antique clock shop. And I just got the shopkeeper to stop them all, and I recorded each clock separately ticking and each clock separately chiming. And then we went back to the studio and made them all chime together. That became the intro to the track. So that was my big contribution.
It's amazing, though, like you said, just how you had to do everything, you know, literally. You really had to get the clock and record the clock and get it all measured up. It's amazing how that's just how things were done. You had to do it that way.
Yeah, it was fairly primitive technology, it has to be said. I mean, the word digital delay didn't exist. I mean, there's enough electronics in a wristwatch or a pedal these days,
right,
to do almost anything you would want. But back then, the only devices were mechanical devices. So if you wanted a different kind of room sound, you would use a different echo chamber, or you would dampen down a room elsewhere, or use a tape machine. Sometimes we would have literally seven or eight tape machines running for a mix, just to get all the various delays and stuff happening. Us and Them was a big challenge to get those vocal delays happening.
Oh.
Us. That, again, in quadraphonic, walks around the room. It goes from front right to front right. That was quite a challenge. We had to use an 8-track machine running at half speed, using two tracks for every delay, because that was considered to be a pretty long delay back then.
Hmm.
Piece of cake now. You just plug in a box and set the delay time and it's done. But back then, just primitive stuff, really difficult to achieve the kind of things which are...
Did you ever hear the story about if you play Dark Side of the Moon with The Wizard of Oz, that it syncs perfectly?
Of course I have.
And of course you did that on purpose, right?
My standard answer, it was Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It wasn't
I was like, how did somebody ever figure that out? Somebody was smoking some weed.
Somebody with much too much time on their hands.
That's right. Exactly. Alan, as we start to wind down here, I want to ask you a few questions about your production career, because we've been talking a lot about you as an engineer. Explain the difference for people that might not understand what a producer really does. Engineering is more like you said, Paul McCartney's telling you, make it sound better. Let's get this sequencing done. As far as producing goes, though, what were kind of your techniques and what were some of the biggest bands that you worked with from a production standpoint?
Well, the role of the producer has actually become much more technical in recent years. I mean, producers basically have to understand digital workstations, you know, have a feel for how, you know, whatever programs being used, Pro Tools or whatever. But still, the underlying job, as far as they're concerned, is to deal with the artist, get the best result from the artist, and leave the sound aspects to the engineer. Or if you if the producer has certain ideas about how something should sound, he would convey that to the engineer, and he would act upon any instructions that the producer might give him. But I think I said earlier, the engineer's job is to keep his mouth shut and make it sound great.
Right.
Unless he's told otherwise. I was one of the first producer engineers to, had always, until probably the early to mid 70s, it had always been two jobs.
Hmm.
And there weren't many people that literally did both jobs. I was very lucky. I managed to land some good artists. One of my first hits was with Pilot, a song called Magic. Oh, 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 it's magic.
It's magic.
That's currently being used for a commercial for some a drug called Ozempic.
Yeah, here we have it in the States, that commercial, yeah.
It is a drug, right? It's not a soap or a... I don't know what it is.
It's one of those commercials where you don't know exactly what the drug is, but they just have a bunch of people running around and having a great time.
Yes. Yeah, so I did well with them. There was a British singer called John Miles that I did really well. He didn't make much of an impact in the States, but and there was Cockney Rebel, again, much more success in Europe than in America. In fact, I had two consecutive number ones with Pilot and Cockney Rebel, which was quite a thrill for me. There was a lot of champagne drunk the night one record took over from the other. And then there was Al Stewart, of course. I mean, he became possibly the best known artist I'd produced over the years. I did three albums with him: Year of the Cat, Time Passages, and the first album, Modern Times.
Yeah, like I said, he had a big run in the States for sure as well. So I guess what I wanted to ask you then is, what do you think is your favorite record that you've ever worked on out of all of them?
Every record has great moments. I think I was proudest of the first Alan Parsons Project album, Tales of Mystery and Imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I'd always enjoyed Edgar Allan Poe, and you know, a really thrilling thing to convert some of his great works to music. And Eric was the same. He loved Poe, and I think he did some great lyrics on the songs that conveyed the atmosphere of the songs. So I felt most proud of that, I think, of all of them. First of a new breed of album, you know, producer, engineer, artist. So I wore three hats for that.
So when you heal up and you do go back out on the road again, when you do your set list now, is it a kind of a whole montage and collage of your whole career?
It's really only the Alan Parsons and Alan Parsons Project music. I don't do any,
of course,
any Beatles or Pink Floyd or anything.
Yeah.
But it's not as if I haven't been asked, though. I've been asked on several occasions to do such thing. But I recognize that our audience wants to hear the hits. If we didn't play Eye in the Sky, they would probably write angry letters and ask for their money back.
If anybody actually writes letters anymore, they would just tweet about it.
Yes. they want to hear the hits. But, you know, we've got a record to promote, so we will be doing a couple of songs from the New World when we get together for rehearsal sometime. I'm hoping to be well enough to do some shows at the end of the year, October, November sometime.
Well, last few things. I saw that you had Joe Bonamassa on the new record as well. What a great player. One of the all-time greats already.
Oh, he was wonderful. And I met him through my publicity people, who had asked him to interview me to promote a live album. That's one of the things we've been doing since the pandemic. We've been putting out live albums.
Right.
One from Holland, which is called The Never Ending Show. Another from Tel Aviv, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
With the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. That's effectively what I've been doing in the pandemic. So Joe interviewed me about those problems.
Gotcha.
And at the end of the interview, I said, Joe, can I ask you, you've been asking me questions. Can I ask you one? And he said, yeah, sure. What is it? I said, will you play on my new album?
Put him on the spot.
He did a great job. We did it again at a distance. And we were face to face in Nashville for that event, but the solo that he did for one of the songs on From the New World was done. Me in Santa Barbara in my studio and him in Nashville.
Last question for you. What's your favorite track on From the New World? And obviously they're all your children, but is the one that stands out for you that you're excited to play live maybe, or that you like the best?
The title From the New World comes from the celebrated Czech composer Antonín Dvořák.
Mm-hmm.
His most famous symphony is called From the New World. I've always wanted to record that symphony in a sort of rock format. We failed to do the entire album, but I'm very keen on one song, which was based on the slow movement, which is called Going Home.
Hmm.
I was somewhat pleased that I did a fairly decent vocal on it. So that's one of the favorite tracks. I'm also very keen on a song called I Won't Be Led Astray, which is the David Pack song.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Alan. I'm glad that you're feeling better, and hopefully you'll be back on the road soon. And once again, man, the Dr. Evil quote, you got your finger up there. It's great.
All right. Nice talking to you.